and welcome back to the Deus Vault podcast.
Deus Vault.
Here we are.
Podcast.
Hey. Yes.
Here we are again.
Hello, back Reverend at the Father. Oh, yes.
Hello, Reverend Father.
It's a very good place to start, as I've heard.
Yes.
In certain places.
Do you like musicals?
Certain ones, maybe.
Okay, I don't know if that, like some people like the genre in general, like, oh, I love musicals. I wouldn't say that either. I like, you know, like Carousel. That's a good one. Is that a, who made Carousel? Is that the same people who made,
See, I don't even know what that one is.
Sound of Music?
That's news to me.
It's an older one. My boy Bill will be tall and as strong as the trees. No?
Nope, not at all. I grew up on Les Mis.
I think that's my uncle's favorite musical. My uncle Greg Holicky. Father Greg Holicky.
Ah, yes.
Of the Gary Diocese. Be that as it may. No, I'm sorry. You were quoting Sound of Music, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Start at the very beginning. Was. Very good place to start.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That's why classic. I asked.
Well, that's a very,
I could have come up with that.
There are certain, that's not what I'm saying. There are certain Catholic elements of that particular.
She's a nun.
Yeah. Helps. Well, she was. Right. And you know, did you know that the Von Trapp family singers, when they did a tour of the United States, they came and sang at the Josephinum?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
My college seminary. So.
Wow.
Yeah. That's anyway, cool. They have interesting history at the Josephinum.
But you're not like set on musicals. That's not like a thing in your heart.
Like I said, for certain things.
Okay,
maybe.
That doesn't count. Yeah. Like I said, I like Carousel.
Yeah.
Or no. My uncle's favorite musical is The Jets and the Sharks.
West Side Story. Sure.
Yeah. And who again? It's the same people who did The Sound of Music. I can't think of those two guys' names. I keep wanting to say Gilbert and Sullivan, but that's British operetta.
That's a completely different thing.
Nah, for something completely different. No. Who were those two guys?
I'm not sure.
Oh, embarrassing myself on my podcast.
I'm not sure. What else? Listeners, dear listeners, help us.
There's going to be so many responses because it's obvious, and plus you can just check the phone, but I'm not going to.
Yeah, anyway, okay.
This is like a conversation you would have back in the 90s where you couldn't remember something and there was no way to find out.
Yeah, Monsignor Google wasn't there to help you.
Yeah, what can you do? Be that as it may. How are you?
I'm doing well. Welcome back to Santo Carlo Rotondo here.
Oh, always and, good being here. It's always good being here. Beautiful day.
It's very good.
Cool.
It's very good. So one of the things that I want to do while I'm here at St. Charles is, and maybe this is something that some of my St. Charles parishioners can help me start getting going. And this isn't necessarily an announcement, but you know, and I'm going to talk to Father Tom and see if he wants to do it too. That was something I'd like to do. I want to study the life of St. Charles, and I want to lead some sort of a retreat and pilgrimage to Italy, tracing his steps.
That'd be very cool.
Yeah. So he was one of the bishops at the Council of Trent.
Mm-hmm.
He was Archbishop of Milan.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, he would have had some doings in Rome. So I'm figuring maybe a kind of a three-part pilgrimage, spend a couple days in each one and just spend like a week or 10 days
doing that. That'd be really cool.
Isn't that neat?
Well,
kind of getting at the spiritual patrimony of our parish, you know, a little bit, yeah.
Did he have a red hat? Was he a cardinal?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So cool.
That's why we're the St. Charles Cardinals.
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah,
Not because we have an affinity for our state bird. That's not what it is.
But the bird itself has the name cardinal because of...
The red hat.
The red hat.
Yeah.
It's not the other way around.
Right.
So, cool.
So it can be both. It can be both.
Very Catholic.
Yeah.
Everything is Catholicism. Including the study of birds. What's on the menu today? What do we have?
Well, speaking of St. Charles Borromeo, having been the Archbishop, the Cardinal Archbishop of Milan, he would have celebrated Mass according to the Ambrosian Rite.
Go on.
What, my dear friend, is the Ambrosian Rite, you ask?
No, I mean, we began, Dan asked me to promise not to be overly jocular. I didn't make that promise, so you don't need to worry out there, people. But I am withholding myself just briefly. Go ahead.
For whatever reason, he likes laughing at me.
Well,
anyway,
I don't like laughing at you. I like finding the humor in things.
Yeah, it's different when there isn't actually humor in things.
What? You're telling me this is some stodgy old rite that has no joy in it?
That's not what I said.
Mm.
Okay.
Come on.
Anyway,
tell me what the Ambrosian Diet is.
It isn't Snickers Comedy Bar either.
I don't know. I could find something. Again, like,
yeah.
This is similar to that drink you guys have in heaven called Ambrosia. Anyways, what's the Ambrosian Diet?
Anyway, referring to St. Ambrose, who had been the Bishop of Milan, right?
He was incorrupt, you know.
Is that right?
Yeah, he is. As a matter of fact, his teeth are still perfect.
No kidding.
If you've never seen his body, you can find it. Speaking of Google, you can find... he's not as... How do I put this? He's reasonably well put together for having been
sounds like you and your priesthood.
1,600 years?
Reasonably well put together. Reasonably well put together.
I don't know if that's the case.
When 1,600 years you reach, look as good you do. Yoda.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great. You're already finding the levity in the Ambrosian Rite.
Yeah, it's not the Ambrosian Rite. Anyway.
Okay. How do you say it?
This is my friend, Father Stephen Felicia.
Hi, at your service. I tip my hat to you if I was wearing one and if you could see me.
Anyway, so St. Ambrose. Do you remember the story of how St. Ambrose became Bishop of Milan?
Oh, he didn't want to be, right?
Right.
Didn't he hide?
Well, okay, so here's the story of St. Ambrose, right? We might have actually told it on the show before, but...
A lot of bishops go through this.
Oh, but...
Saintly bishops.
His is insane because he was only a catechumen.
Oh, I do remember his story.
Yeah,
go ahead, tell it.
Okay.
You go for it. So here...
So there
Ambrose was. And like Ambrose is like a... He's really smart, really talented. He wants to be a Christian, but like he's busy running a city, basically, as I understand it.
Milan.
And the people, like their bishop dies and there's a riot. I love it when Christians riot and they're good Christians because they're like, let's go make Ambrose bishop. And they literally like go storming his place and they drag him out kicking and screaming.
Well, here's what happens.
Go ahead.
Okay, here's a little bit of a detail to that because it's just very funny. So the problem is you have like the Arian heresy going on at the time.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So you have like...
Normal
Orthodox, lowercase o, Orthodox,
non-heretical Christians, yeah.
Right, who are in the cathedral in Milan, and they're fighting back and forth with these Arian heretics, and there's a disturbance breaking out, and so they call, like, the governor, who is Ambrose, and he comes in, and he's able to enter into discourse with both sides and get everyone to calm the heck down, okay. And in the midst of all of the conversation, apparently, the story goes, a little boy.
Ambrose or Bishop.
Ambrosius Episcopus. And everyone starts chanting, Ambrose Bishop. Ambrose Bishop. Ambrose Bishop. And he's like,
no!
But sure enough, he answers the Lord's call by, you know, the happenstance of a crazy situation. And he, you know... Gets baptized, gets confirmed, first Eucharist, ordination, bang, bang, bishop, like, in the course of a few hours. Yeah, basically. You got it all figured out really quickly. So that's the sort of the legend behind St. Ambrose.
I'll take it, because that's too good not to be true.
Right. So this is still a pretty early life of the church, right?
What year is this? Like 400 or something?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's close to that.
Yeah, it's really not long after Constantine made, you know, Christianity
like legal.
Legal, regularized in the Roman Empire. So, okay. Anyway, and it's actually, we're approaching the fall of the Roman Empire, right?
Well, I mean, technically, if you want to get, like, 600 is the fall.
Sure.
At this point, like, the western half of the empire is starting to decay real rapidly.
Sure.
And the east, I mean, Constantinople's already been established, so there is this eastern half of the empire, which is kind of starting to do its own thing.
Right, yeah. Right. So anyway, one of the contexts, though, is one of the important things to remember about this situation is that there are Arians everywhere.
That's a meme.
Arians everywhere.
There was a double hand motion there. I wish you could see it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of that going on.
Well, we're in Italy, so we're talking with our hands.
I thought we were
Milan.
In Fort Wayne.
We're in Milan.
Okay.
We're talking with our hands.
See, wait a minute now here. You're like, no, we've got to be really serious about that.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. You're just not allowed to laugh at things that are actually important. Okay.
Go on.
Okay, so... All right, so that's Ambrose's situation. He's dealing with Arian heretics. Right? Now, in that situation, what happens when the Arians take over is they actually, there's a lot. It's like, I think it's almost like the majority, or if not the majority of Christians are Arians in Western Europe. At the height of the Arian heresy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now what happens? We have to think about liturgy in a sort of a historical perspective for a minute here, okay?
Go on.
Liturgy organically develops, right? We have a situation where it is meant to organically develop over time.
Well, I mean, right? Like if this wasn't somebody's like step-by-step plan, if that's what you're getting at. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, so it changes sort of only bit by bit over the course of the years.
Well, the first centuries. Mass, again, like the first mass is literally the Last Supper, which right. Jesus Christ takes apparently a Passover meal or one close enough there too, mm-hmm. and alters it because, right. well, you know, he's God.
And of course, the liturgy is all wrapped up in his own crucifixion, of course.
Exactly. I mean, like, that's always an interesting thought in my mind is like the overlap between that and the crucifixion, because he's literally, before the crucifixion is happening, taking the crucifixion and bringing it backwards in time.
Well, it's an entire mystery. Of, I know. So it's just, but the same thing is, like, the consecration isn't done until you've consecrated both what's on the paten and in the chalice.
Yes, exactly. Right? Exactly.
So, like, these things both have to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but, like, you know, a consecration has happened, but the entire mystery of the Eucharist hasn't been sort of been developed all the way through Mass.
Right. So, anyway, so, like, this in memory of me is a thing that's going on. And right. it's very clear, even from, like, Paul's letter, I want to say it's in Corinthians. But, like, where he's like, you guys are doing it wrong. It's yeah, like, you guys right. are getting drunk in the middle of, like, the consecration. That's not cool.
No, you can't do that.
So, like, there is this – so there's this growth obviously occurring as literally the liturgy of the Eucharist is – developing isn't, I think, a wrong word.
It's, right, well, yeah.
It's I mean, growing, I right. dare say. Like, we're realizing, like, we really shouldn't be doing this, mm-hmm. and this is a good idea, and mm-hmm. – Yeah, Hippolytus keeps coming up. Hippolytus.
He's going to come up later, by the way.
He writes a description in, I want to say it's the 200s, mm-hmm. of like, this is sort of what the liturgy is. I mean, it's not, again, it's not like step-by-step rubrics, but he's basically like, yeah, this is sort of what happens at the Mass. And of course, we always mention Justin Martyr whenever this sort of comes up too. Like, his apologetic work directed to the emperor is literally explaining, like, this is what the Mass kind of is happening as it's going on. Mm-hmm. I don't think he uses the word Mass, but he says, this is how we worship on Sunday.
Right. This and is then, when we come together to worship the Lord, this is what we do.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, no, yeah, to say that it's organic, that it's like this growth of, like, it's funny to say, we're learning how to be reverent. We're learning
sort of
how to yeah. encapsulate this and it's
right. and to make relevant isn't the right word, but sort of to make able to be brought into one's own home this liturgy in all places in the world.
That's right? A very interesting way of putting it, because again, the early Christians were meeting in their first homes to right. say their masses.
Right.
But anyways, the first church homes or home churches.
Exactly. But this sort of thing starts going on, I mean, all over the Christian world. Okay, so yeah, right after the apostolic era, you know, you have some of these, you know, first like church father, the church father
church
era.
Fathers, yeah,
and Ambrose is one of the
is considered fathers. A church. I mean, it's right. I mean, you're like, well, that's not within living memory. That's not exactly what it means.
Yeah,
I think we've right. talked about that
because
earlier.
even Augustine is considered a church father.
Right? Well, dude, kind of I mean, we can push it out to don't they push it out to Bernard?
I think so far as that's Middle Ages, isn't it?
Well, early Middle Ages.
Okay.
Like yeah. 600.
Okay. So, oh, well, maybe. So anyway, there's a little bit of a difference in what you think about, but definitely Ambrose.
As early as him. No one doubts him as far as that title goes.
Right. So a father of the church to speak of. But even before Ambrose, right, in the fathers of the church, we're starting to figure out how this liturgy, this commemoration, this representation of Calvary is sort of lived and worked in the liturgical action,
right?
And it's different in a lot of places. So you have, speaking of another church father, St. John Chrysostom.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So you have the Divine Liturgy.
Oh, the Divine Liturgy!
Right. The Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom is basically the form of liturgy that...
Sorry, drop something. We're good.
He's over here shaking his cassock out.
Go ahead. We're fine. You were saying...
It's like emptying out your potato sack after a potato sack race. Where's my pencil at?
I would have been cheating. There's a big hole in the bottom of my potato sack. And that's how I've won all the races.
You're wearing it upside down.
Yeah. You fools.
Sackcloth and ashes over here. Anyway.
Go ahead.
Thanks for the sidebar. I know. It's great. So St. John Chrysostom, right? He's credited with writing, and I think it's pretty clear that he basically did put together and assemble four... the sort of unified worship of Eastern Christians, divine liturgy of St. John, which is now known as the divine liturgy.
What you see in the Eastern rites mm-hmm. and in the Orthodox churches, to my knowledge, is principally very slight moderations of what Christendom set up.
Yeah, variations on a theme maybe a little bit. But I mean, by and large, mm-hmm. the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom is the one. And I think they also use the liturgy of St. Anselm, if I'm remembering correctly. I might be totally wrong about that. But I know they have two liturgies. Of course, they use St. John Chrysostom the most.
If we have any Eastern Rite listeners, again, we're not resorting to the internet. We prefer human contact. I like the human touch. If you could write in and tell us, that'd be great. Go ahead.
Anyway, so that's just a basic understanding, right? That certain saints, in receiving the tradition of the faith, you know, sort of put together and sort of codified mm-hmm. the ways that the community would pray.
Sure.
So just sort of make it so that we're actually doing the same thing each Sunday and not just sort of coming up with it as we go. Cool. Right? So it's good to be organized.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing happened basically all over the Christian world, right? Now, here's the thing. Obviously, you have all the different traditions in the East. You have like the Antiochian, and you have the Coptics, and you have the Byzantines, and you have all them, right? And some of these things are very different from each other. Big one in the Orthodox world, St. John Chrysostom. Mm-hmm. Okay, going to Rome, going to the Western world, you start to see it's very, very clear that it has roots in those old liturgies, right?
More. In the Eastern line, shall we say?
Right. Well, and it's actually very, very clear if we sort of pay attention closely to how the Ambrosian Rite is lived and worked out, there are some things about it that are very Greek, which is interesting. So I need to make sure that I say, just for sake of proper credit where credit is due. I have an article here by Mr. Gregory DePippo, who wrote an article about his own experience of attending and even serving the Ambrosian Rite in Milan. So thank you to Mr. DePippo. it's very Italian. So anyway, his experience of it though is like listening. So it's Milan is in Italy,
right?
Right, and you
it's
think,
the north or south? It's south, right?
No, it's a northern.
It's northern.
It's a northern. Yeah. So
this must have been an overflow. Somehow the traditions got in from Greece.
Well, a little bit, and especially in the chant, right? So the liturgy is in Latin. It's still a Western liturgy,
right?
So to speak. But like if you were to listen to the chants of it, it wouldn't sound like Gregorian chant. It sounds like something that is. It smacks of, you know, like a Greek Orthodox sounding. It's a different, totally different mode.
We should have really had Father Dennis here so that he can sort of, he really knows the tonality of that Greek sound.
Right.
Because I wouldn't dare attempt it myself.
Well, I mean, dear listener, go look up, you know, either a Greek Orthodox or a Greek Catholic liturgy and listen to the style of chant.
It's really beautiful.
And then compare that to Gregorian chant. Like mm-hmm. it's noticeably different, but still completely and utterly, you know, beautiful and self-contained.
Well, this is like the interesting thing. Speaking of like organic growth, like the seeds mm-hmm. of all of this, I recently learned, mm-hmm. are the Psalms themselves.
Yeah.
It's Jewish ancient Hebrew chant.
Right.
And mm-hmm. Gregorian chant is actually just something of a slight modification of whatever that used to sound like.
It's gone through a couple different iterations. Gregorian chant has roots in old Roman chant, mm-hmm. and old Roman chant has roots in something older still, goes back to Greek, and then eventually it goes back to the way that the Psalms were chanted even in the temple. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, this is a very, very Judeo-Christian tradition, right? This is something that's been passed down for even longer than just from the apostolic times.
Seeds come from the temple. Anyway.
It's true.
But no, so, there it is. And so like Gregorian chant and this Greek chant, I don't know what we would call it.
Well, I would just go ahead and say Ambrosian.
Ambrosian chant. Am I saying that right? Ambrosian?
Ambrosian, yeah.
I'm going to slip into Ambrosia again. Go ahead.
Anyway, so, yeah. So anyway, the Ambrosian Rite. It's interesting, though, because we have to understand, I think it's really, really important. We can kind of get a little bit myopic, especially being in the United States.
Good word use.
Well, the reality is, especially in our culture nowadays, it's really easy to only be focused on what's happening right now without our own historical context.
Oh, we're good at that.
And some of that is also because, as Americans, we don't have a very long history in our own country, right? So,
oh no, again, like we're talking about Christianity like 400 years after it begins,
right?
And America's only what, 280 years old,
right?
Something
so
like that.
there you go, right?
Well, like 250 even, I think. Or,
and, yeah. and our nation has a largely Protestant foundation,
yeah.
So it's not got sort of the patristic era, you know, Catholic vibe to it.
Don't listen to our Thanksgiving episode, people.
Well, actually, yeah, that does work. That does work with that. So, but it's interesting because in the life of the church in the West, so, you know, I'm talking about the Catholic world.
Yeah.
There actually was for a time, there were many different expressions of Western Christian life, Western Catholic life.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are some that actually still exist today, and there were even some of these forms of liturgy that were associated with particular religious orders. So, so we're talking about the Ambrosian Rite.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the Roman Rite.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you also have the Mozarabic Rite, which is in, I believe, Toledo. It's in Spain.
Yeah.
So anyway,
to say nothing of the Eastern Rites, of course.
Well, and then, of course, you
which
have
we already started with.
Eastern Catholics, but
right.
Of course, that stuff comes from a tradition of
Orthodoxy.
Of like, you know, yeah, Orthodoxy, mm-hmm. John Chrysostom.
Right.
But then among religious orders, perhaps a little bit more modern, still 800 years old, right? The Dominican Rite.
Right.
Okay.
And, right. The Dominican Rite.
Right. Well, and then alongside it, the Carmelite Rite. Okay. So there are bunches of different expressions of what's happening at Mass, the divine liturgy,
ooh,
the heavenly liturgy made present on earth by the actions and the sacraments and the rituals.
Right.
There are lots of them. And maybe we can get really, really focused in on just what's happening at St. Charles Borromeo Catholic Church, Fort Wayne. Like, I mean, we're not celebrating the Mozarabic Rite here, you know? We're not celebrating the Carmelite Rite here, you know? So it's just outside of our purview. We don't have sort of a sense of it unless
But I mean, we even lost such a huge sense of, like, this is interesting. You ever read Tree Grows in Brooklyn? It's a work of fiction.
I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
I own it.
I don't even own it.
Oh, I'll loan you my copy. It's really good. But it's about, you know, the Catholic ghetto in the 1950s and kids coming up who are somewhat poor Irish kids. And it might be a little earlier than that. I think it might be in like the 40s even. But anyways, they're growing up and they're Catholic. It's not a story specifically about Catholicism, but like it's very clearly
backdrop
Catholic ghetto kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they are their encounter with the Mass in the 40s and the 50s is something that implies they are connected to something much, much, much greater in a historical sense. So you got these kids who are like squabbling over, you know, like jacks in the alleyway, bouncing balls. It's, you know, classic 40s, 50s kish. And then you've got like, and they know they're part of something much, much wider than Brooklyn. Than just like their own little small part of the world and the way they currently live. And the liturgy sort of links them into that in a way that is unique to the time, perhaps. Whereas in the 70s and the 80s, it's amazing how much we forgot.
It's true.
Again, like I remember being taught – well, I think I've said this before. I was so confused by Grandma's high altar. I didn't even know what it was because they weren't using it. They had a freestanding altar, and the priest was going versus populum.
Oh, yeah.
But the which is to say he was facing the people, and as he said, Mass. And I remember asking my dad, like, what is that big marble thing back there? It looks like a castle. And Dad said, oh, that's the old high altar. The priest used to say the Mass with that. And I said, how did they have to stand on the ledge to face the people? I literally had no idea how they were doing.
Right.
But there it was within living memory. Because again, my dad had served the Latin Mass.
Yeah.
There was complete obliteration of even its existence and its connection to other sort of rites, to other sort of to the history of the church. It was gone. Mm-hmm. And again, I remember reading, you know, we used to say the Mass in Latin. Like, again, that blew my mind in grade school. I had no idea. And I was getting, like, and I'm talking like middle school, sixth, seventh, eighth. Whereas you would think we would have had a better, well, again, like living memory. That was the 90s, for crying out loud. That was only 30 years had gone by. And we had no idea what was going
on. Well, actually, it was the Missal of St. Paul the VI's 1970. So in the 90s, it's not even 25.
It's not even 25 years.
Like about 25
years. Right, about 25 years. So but we had completely lost all sense of it. Whereas, again,
like one generation later.
Yeah.
You know, it's nuts.
Barely.
Yeah.
And the, not even. Anyways, I digress. Yes, in America, we are terrible at remembering anything. That was a long way of my point is.
Yeah.
Like, we're just atrocious at remembering stuff.
It's true.
Let alone 100 years back, let alone 800 years back.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so I just want to make sure I have a couple other ones that popped up. The Sarum Rite, which was in the British Isles, I'm pretty sure. And then the Gallican Rite, which I think was in France, obviously,
right,
Gaul.
Right.
So you have all these different forms, right?
That one's interesting. That one has a lot of political connotations,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it does, with Charlemagne and stuff like that, right?
Anyways, go on.
So anyway, so there's some stuff going on with that. And it's important to read up on this history. But anyway, I want to go through really quickly, just so we don't miss out on some of the particularities of
the Ambrosian Rite. Yeah, holy smoke, sorry. Long segues, go ahead.
No, it's great, because there's all sorts of fun little things that are just different enough to make you go, what is that, you know? Like, if you were to go to Milan and encounter an Ambrosian Rite Mass, these are some things you might run into, okay? So in the procession, it's coming from the back of the church to the sanctuary, the procession stops in the middle of the nave, and there is this sort of 12-fold Kyrie.
Really?
Yes, a Lord have mercy.
Has the Mass even technically begun yet?
No.
Ah!
No. Cool. And that's that actually, I mean, with that many of them in a row, that's a very Eastern thing, right?
That's very true.
It's a very Eastern thing to have so many Kyries, Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, right? Sung over and over again like that.
Right, a constant repetition.
Right, right. So that's kind of an Eastern thing, right?
Yeah.
But like, it's been brought home in Milan. Okay, great. This particular article that Mr. DePippo wrote was talking about a recent experience he had of serving a Mass, an Ambrosian Rite Mass during Lent.
Yeah.
And so he was talking about, in the Sundays of Lent, the Sundays are named not the first Sunday of Lent, the second Sunday of Lent. It's actually named directly after the Gospels of those particular days. Which there's some of that still remains. Like, we have Good Shepherd Sunday.
Sure, we do.
Right. Some of the other ones.
We sure do.
We absolutely do. The first Sunday is called the beginning of the fast. The rest are known by their Gospels. So the Sunday of the Samaritan woman, the Sunday of Abraham, the Sunday of the blind man, the Sunday of Lazarus, and then Palm Sunday.
So cool.
Which is also called Olive Sunday. Do you know why?
No.
Some things are incredibly practical. It's much easier to find olive branches than palm branches in Milan.
Oh.
so they kind of gained, like, well, we just use olive branches and sort of
use
your imagination a little bit.
Yeah, use your imagination.
Kind of. I mean, think about being in Milan in the like 400s. You're not going to get palm branches anywhere.
No, you need to know somebody.
Right. I mean, even if you were to go to Rome, like where they do have palm trees, like, yeah, you're too far away to kind of get them readily.
Right.
So anyway, that's something.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So wait, I'm sorry. What is Ambrose's actual connection to this? Did they say he codified that?
Well, so here's the thing. There are some sort of there are some historical connections that are made textually. Like, there are some people who have commented on where this came from and Ambrose's involvement. They think Ambrose was involved because whatever form the Ambrosian Rite was taking before he was even bishop,
right?
It's thought that there was a lot of Arian influence into the Mass.
Ooh.
And so there were some things that had gotten inserted that should not have been inserted, mm-hmm. and they were basically turning it into a heretical form of liturgy.
Gotcha.
So Eve slowly, you know, like poisoning the liturgy.
Right. No, that's a thing that can happen.
Right. So,
that's a method of. I mean, well, anyways, don't let me go down the Nazi rabbit hole.
Well, kind of.
That's how you do it.
This is not the first time this has happened. Right? No,
exactly. So, I mean, like suddenly, you know, and nothing per se wrong with it, having Jesus Christ on the cross with blonde hair and blue eyes. But then
right.
things start also getting added in.
Well, lex orandi, lex credendi, lex vivendi. So the law of prayer affects the law of how people mm-hmm. believe, affects the law of how people live. That's, mm-hmm. That makes a difference, right?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so... they thought that Ambrose corrected some of those things. And he was a sort of a reformer of the liturgy as it was being said in Milan.
Very cool.
So, yeah. There's some historical problems with that. It may not be completely him or only him. There may have been some other people involved.
But yet the name sticks.
Right, right. But because he was such an important figure for Milan, for reforming them in the time of Arian heresies, He gained the credit for it, right?
Okay, cool.
So anyway, let's get to a couple more little
things. Go ahead.
No, it's great. So in Lent, there's no Gloria, but in the place of a Gloria, there are certain litanies that'll be sung. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting one. This actually smacks, this goes back to our one on the saints.
Come on.
Because in one of the litanies, there's a sort of an invocation, a prayer for, an intercession for, those in metallis.
In the middle?
In the mines.
In the mines. Oh, the mines of Sardinia.
Yeah. So it's thought that this is one of the last remaining things in the Western Catholic world in our liturgy that's pre-Constantinian. Like before the legalization of Christianity in the Western, in Rome, in the Western, you know, Europe.
That's really, really, really cool.
Isn't that neat? So, and of course, like, you know, what, isn't that archaic? Shouldn't we get rid of that? Well,
there's still people in the mines.
There's people who work in the mines. Yeah. They make great money doing what they're doing.
Right.
But also, I mean, there are plenty of people who are in persecution, right?
Right.
It's a way to pray for persecuted Christians.
Right. It takes on a much more symbolic role. But right. Again, there's still plenty of mm-hmm. slavery in the world, unfortunately.
Right. And there's plenty of us who, I mean... consider your own life. You know, how many mines are you caught in?
Yeah.
Right?
No, there's a lot of truth in that.
So that's one thing, too.
Well, it's very, again, and it was inserted, I dare say, into the Latin liturgy, I'm pretty sure. God save us from the Northmen. When the Vikings kept hitting, it made its way all the way into the liturgy.
Well, actually, so that's in the traditional Latin Mass. The reason that the gospel is proclaimed facing the liturgical north is like a proclamation of the gospel to the barbarians
in the north. Coming from the north. Very cool.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So anyway, okay. The list of saints. So, my friends, perhaps you're used to hearing in the first Eucharistic prayer, Linus, Cletus, Clement, Sixtus, Cornelius, Cyprian, Lawrence, Chrysogonus, John, and Paul, Cosmas, and Damian. Okay.
And all the saints.
Right, exactly. In the Ambrosian Rite, they actually don't list Linus and Cletus, not because they don't like Linus and Cletus, but they have other saints who they add into that place. Okay.
Are they local saints?
Hippolytus.
Ah, then my boy!
Yeah. So, Hippolytus. Vincent Apollinaris, whose feast day was recently celebrated.
Yeah.
Vitalis.
First Bishop of Ravenna, I think.
Ravenna?
Ravenna?
I think it's Ravenna. I think you're right.
potato, tomato.
Nazarius and Chelsus, by the way,
never knew him.
It's their feast today.
Oh.
And then
guys.
Protasius and Gervasius, and then Victor, referring to Victor the First. Whose feast is also today, by the way.
Yeah.
July 28th when we're recording this.
Hey, super cool.
Yeah, anyway. So I'm like, oh, that's great. So they're definitely, this is a great conversation, the presence of the saints.
That's very fitting because Victor was all tied up in the whole Callistus Hippolytus mess.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but it's funny because it's Saint Victor the First.
Yeah.
You know? So, there's something to be said for that, right? Neighbor, Felix, and Calimarius. And the other list of saints also has different saints. But I thought it was great that, for one thing, on the feast day of these particular saints,
we're talking about them
in the context of the Ambrosian Rite.
This was not planned. I don't know when you came up with this idea. When did you check?
I
How did you find out?
I just learned that particular reality this morning when I was researching this.
That's so cool.
But yeah, beautiful. Yeah. I thought to do a thing on the Ambrosian Rite for a couple weeks, but anyways, this is just perfect, right?
This is a sign. We'll take that as a good sign.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a couple more things. After the consecration, the priest holds his arms out to the sides in a cruciform manner, and I don't remember exactly how long. Okay. But that's actually something you see in the Carmelite, right?
Oh.
And in the Dominican Rite.
Ooh.
And I don't know if it's other places, but like, it's an interesting thing because, like, the priest in that moment of the consecration
is taking on the full person of Christ crucified.
Exactly right. This is my body, right? Like, and then he shows himself in the form of the cross of Christ, right?
That's very cool.
So, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Yes, yes, I love it.
There's a whole other Italian.
Yeah.
Father Pietro.
Oh, I miss him.
Okay.
Anyways.
And then, actually, something interesting about the Ambrosian Rite is there's no Agnus Dei. Okay?
Okay.
But here's an interesting thing. This is one of those things that sort of leans into, like, the organic growth of liturgy. You know, there's the communion antiphon. Everyone's sort of, and maybe in some places they don't necessarily do it, but in the missal, there's printed the communion antiphon, which is something that can be chanted or simply spoken by the priest right before, or maybe someone will chant it during or right after communion. You know, everyone comes to receive communion. So they're much longer in the Ambrosian Rite, and they usually take sort of a threefold form, very much like the Agnus Dei.
Very cool.
Okay.
So, very cool.
Okay. So the thought is that perhaps eventually they just kind of got down to, let's just keep this one form of the sort of this communion antiphon, which, by the way, in the Ambrosian Rite is called the Transitorium, which is like the...
it's hardcore.
Well, think about like the communication, right? Being brought to and the Eucharist being transferred from the sanctuary into the world, into the nave where it's given for communion, right?
Gotcha.
The transitorium, right? Yeah. So that's what that word sort of means.
The movement kind of thing, yeah.
Right. So so it's thought that maybe the Agnus Dei was one of these, and it just stuck in the Roman Rite.
Oh.
And then the way that the communion antiphon happened, it was something that just changed gradually away from its previous form.
Sure.
Or something. There was some sort of a mutual... feeding off of each other there.
Right.
So just really interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it's just beautiful. So if you ever get a chance, you know, maybe you're my parishioner. We're going to go to Milan someday. Maybe we'll see an Ambrosian Rite liturgy.
And Father Shoemaker is going to get all these calls. Father Dan says we're going to Milan.
What? No intense plans with that yet. I'd love to do it. I think it'd be great. And especially, you know, sort of knowing that Charles Borromeo celebrated this mass. In fact, he was a defensor of it. Oh, this is interesting.
A defender?
He was a defender of the Milanese Rite, the Ambrosian Rite. So,
what do you have to defend it from? Is probably a good question.
Well, okay. So here's another piece of how liturgy sort of
grows
and stuff. Right? It's the work.
My liturgy grows where Rosemary goes. Sorry.
What? Anyway,
it's a reference to a song. Anyways.
Gotcha.
Okay. My love grows where Rosemary goes. Anyways.
Great. Anyway.
I only know that because I've watched a movie once isn't worth talking about. Go on.
Okay.
The behemoth. Sorry.
Anyway. So, St. Charles Borromeo was around during the Council of Trent.
Yes.
What happened with the Council of Trent is you had sort of a lot of different forms of the liturgy sort of sprouting up all over the place. And one of the ways that they sort of curtailed that in sort of as pastoral a way as possible is Pius V said, okay, any liturgy that's younger than 200 years, that is, hasn't withstood the test of time.
Right.
Those things are to be abrogated and they're not supposed to be done anymore. Because we're getting to the point where we have like just too many expressions of
it. And it's on top of the Protestant revolt at the same time. It's on top of the Protestant Reformation.
It's like, and let's get organized here.
And exactly, you know? Because like people are going into places and they don't know if it's a Catholic mass or not.
Right.
And that's not good for anybody.
Right. You should be able to know.
Right.
So there are some places in which like the long-standing tradition of whatever liturgy, you know, okay, fine, that's been here fine, you can keep it, mm-hmm. right? And especially for certain religious orders. But like I mentioned some of them, right? The Mozarabic rite, I think the Benedictines had their own thing at one time.
I don't know.
I can't remember.
That one's news to me.
The Carthusians did too. But the Dominicans, the Carmelites, and then we started to fall into some of the discourse around
the Ambrosian rite.
The Ambrosian rite. Let me go to the history here. So newadvent.org has a history of the
Ambrosian. Just stop by newadvent.org. They got all kinds of cool stuff.
Everything. It's so good. Okay. Let me make sure I find the right part. Okay. The Ambrosian rite was safe until around the Council of Trent. The rule of that council that local uses, which could show a prescription of 2 centuries, might be retained, saved Milan, not without a struggle, from the toss of its rite. And St. Charles Borromeo, though he made some alterations in a Roman direction, was most careful not to destroy its characteristics. A small attempt made against it by the governor of Milan, which is sort of a funny problem. A funny historical problem.
Laughing this time.
Yeah. Who had obtained a permission from the Pope to have the Roman Mass said in any church which he might happen to attend, was defeated by St. Charles, and his own revisions were intended to do little more than what was inevitable in a living rite. So it's interesting. This is this is an excerpt from the Catholic Encyclopedia. Yeah. The Catholic Encyclopedia.
Very cool.
So even the Catholic Encyclopedia sort of has this sense that like some liturgies are going to kind of slowly change over time according right. to the needs of that population. That's according just the way it to happens. The right. And it's going to be slow. It's going to be gradual. It's going to be sort of it's going to mimic sort of the sense of the faithful in that place.
Sensus fideum.
Yeah. The sensus fidelium? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, right. So, and there's of course a little bit more that goes into this, but St. Charles Borromeo ends up being sort of a defender of it.
Hey, good for him.
Yeah. Make sure I didn't miss anything else. Nope. I mean, that's basically it with that. But, you know, some of the reason why I bring some of these things to our attention is because right now in the life of the church, we're sort of facing into again. And it's an interesting problem because it's like trying to teach a history class about current events. It's impossible.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not going to really get into some of the politics of it, but right now Pope Francis recently, you know, put out this new motu proprio,
Guardians of the Tradition,
right. In which there has been a pretty serious pullback on permissions being given to priests who know how to say the traditional Latin Mass.
Yes.
And this is sort of wrapped up in what happened in, at the end of the Second Vatican Council, and especially with the Missal of Paul VI, the 1970, 69 and 70, right in that area.
Mentioned earlier in this episode.
Right, exactly. So, but it's interesting because like some of this, yes, is going to be a part of that constant deliberation about what liturgy is. And it's also important to recognize that sometimes people, we can't always have, it's really easy to fall into error about how we treat liturgy.
Yes.
Right. And so
if the last 50 years have taught us anything.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, the sensus fidelium hasn't really been a very, very well trained conscience, a well-formed conscience on that.
That's an interesting point. I might not entirely agree with that.
Okay.
It might very well be that it has. Anyways.
I don't really know what you mean by that. But anyway, we're just going to sort of leave it. But I think we both can agree on is like the things where we had like clown masses.
That's sort of what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
What was it? I mean, here, I've always thought this was one of the best examples of a sensus fideum. A priest once stood up, I was told by a man who was there. He was he's probably in his late 60s when he told me, he might be in his 70s now. He said he was in a class and a priest stood up and told the people, you know, it's not important that your children go to Sunday Mass. You know, if you take them out into the woods or something and they can find God there, it's great. He said he saw another guy in the room, a layman, stand up and said, Father, he says, if you're teaching that in school, you're going to hell.
Oh, okay. I see what you were trying to make the point of. Is that there are some people who are better catechized than a priest.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Again, like there was, you know, the clown mass wasn't a movement of the people. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
The
yeah. I would say that there's a lot.
There wasn't a strong demand of the people for that.
No, there's not.
And in fact, I dare say there was quite a visceral reaction against it.
Right.
Sense of the people.
Right. So I mean, that's a little bit
right.
Right. So that whole thing is a bit more of an overt sort of accidental property to the liturgy.
Yes.
That was imposed upon the poor people of God at the time.
Right.
But and that didn't happen everywhere, you know. But it in some places it totally happened. but there
have
are
it
more
on video.
Yeah, and there are more sort of important sort of more philosophical problems about how the liturgy sort of just changed overnight with the end of the Second Vatican Council that are still being talked about by people who are much higher above my pay grade.
Yeah.
And so I would say, for one thing, dear people, do a good study of the history of liturgy, especially in this time when we kind of have this modo proprio sort of land on us. And also, it's important for everybody on any part of the spectrum to have charity towards each other.
Yes.
Which is, yeah. I mean,
which goes back to the last episode, can be kind of lacking.
Yeah.
Again.
It's important. I mean, that's important in every aspect of life. But there are some people who like the traditional traditional Latin Mass who are extremely hurting right now.
Oh yeah,
you know, and who like their faith has been bolstered by the presence of and kind of the open, availability of the traditional Latin Mass.
Cool.
Who feel kind of squashed right now.
Oh yeah,
and on the other side, there are people who are sort of, I mean, there are lots of parishioners here at St. Charles who maybe don't have any contact with the Latin Mass at all, who only hear the very loud, you know, portion of traditional Latin Mass goers who are dang near, you know, heretics.
The blogosphere is not the best place to meet people.
Right.
If you want to draw some wide conclusions about them, don't go online.
But the reality is most of the people who are in the pews who are quietly, you know, praying to the Lord and who are willing to suffer through trials, those exist both in traditional Latin Mass communities and in regular run-of-the-mill parish people.
Yeah, it exists inside the Catholic Church.
And so I would say pay less attention to the loud people who are I don't know how to say, basically not very good theologians who just like to make noise.
Jesus Christ doesn't abandon his church, brothers and sisters.
Right. There are a lot of things that are still, for one thing, this is one of the part of the thing of like trying to teach a history lesson based on current events. There are so many things about this that are still sort of coming around that we don't really know what this modo proprio really means yet. They're still grappling with it, and it's going to take a little while to figure out what it even means.
Yes, it will.
Also, I would say it's important for everybody to be patient with each other while we're all dealing with this in different ways. I would say try to learn each other's perspectives. Try to learn each other's perspectives and be open to the perspectives of other people. It's important to be intellectually sound as Catholics.
Well, that pretty much sums up the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, well, that's one of the part of the realities is we're not really allowed, we shouldn't really be allowed to be, or allow ourselves to be ignorant of the things that are going on in the church.
Absolutely not. You must pay attention.
Yep. And give it true thought, you know. It's important. It's important to have these sort of discussions and also to be open to different ways in which people pray, right? And some of that was true, like you said, it's like our last episode. We're sitting here talking with Mr. Hagar, and he's talking about how, like, look, I love the traditional Latin Mass, but I also go to praise and worship stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
Let's make the distinction. Let's not, you know, don't cross the streams.
Dude, that new Ghostbuster trailer looks amazing. Have you not seen
that? That's high praise coming from you.
Oh, dude, we'll talk about that offline. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, so don't cross the stream.
You haven't seen it yet, have you?
There are important places in which, you know, praise and worship music can happen. And there is important time for liturgy to be solemn and to pull us into something that's greater than ourselves in a different way than, you know, and in a liturgical way, in a sacramental way, that simply, you know, even the most faithful of guitar playing praise and worship bands can't provide. Yeah. You know, that's just part of the sacramental life of the church. So that's all I'll say about that. I think it's just important. And this was going into Milan in the 400s. This was sort of just an entryway into talking about that greater, that sort of greater reality that's still happening in the life of the church. You know, liturgy is going to be a part of our life for our entire lives as Catholics. It should be.
Quite right? Literally into eternity too, brothers and sisters.
Right, exactly.
Heaven is all liturgy.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, and we have that great hope that in this life we are prepared well to fully, consciously, actively participate in the divine liturgy of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that's about. And be open to learning about the patrimony that you have as a Catholic. I will say that I know and have said the traditional Latin Mass, and it has been a boon to my priesthood already. You know, and so there are still, I believe, according to the new motu proprio, I have to ask permission from Bishop to continue to do that. And I will. And it sounds like he's being very generous with that.
Praise God.
Thanks be to God. But yeah, and it's going to continue to be a spiritual part of, rather, it'll continue to augment my spiritual life in a particular way. Just as much and, you know, right alongside as me saying Mass right here at St. Charles in the ordinary form.
Praise God.
And, you know, being with people of God. And it's important.
And bringing Jesus Christ to the people. The transferium or whatever it was.
I've already lost it.
Yeah. It's unobtainium.
Unobtainium. the transitorium. Transitorium. So, yeah. Participating in the transitorium.
For my praise people. God.
But anyway, so that's that. Any final remarks, Father Stephen?
No. You know me. I like to laugh. You were worried we were going to laugh too much. I don't think that's... I think half of music is laughter. Anyways.
Okay.
The other half is quite structured and needed. Anyways.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But there's a communication of joy in liturgy. Mm-hmm. And if it's not doing that... and then I don't mean like in the sense of entertainment. I'm not talking about just petty pleasure or entertainment. I'm talking about joy. And the liturgy must communicate that authentically. Mm-hmm. And again, joy isn't necessarily an overpowering giddiness, despite how much I may actually laugh. it's a communication of awe and power. And yes, an overwhelming sense of the good and your unity to it. That is joy. So, that's all I have to say about that.
That's all I got to say about that. That's from Forrest Gump.
Yeah, I know. You ain't got no legs, Lieutenant Dan.
I know. Lieutenant Dan, you've got matched legs.
Tell him about...
Is that where we're going to end this episode? Okay, anyway.
I think that's appropriate.
This has been the Deus Fault Podcast. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and online. And you can email us at deusfaultpodcast@gmail.com. I'm going to get back to some of you. I've been letting some of you kind of hang for a minute. Don't worry, I'm coming for you.
Makes you stronger.
That's right. What? Sure.
What? Yeah. Like isometric workout. We'll talk about that in the next podcast, maybe. Okay, go ahead. Finish it up, Dan. Come on. You let me talk? Talk. Finish.
That's all. As always, God bless you.
Deus Vult.